episode of the Here's Johnny podcast. I am your host, Larry.
And I am your other host, Justin. A very special episode this week.
Yes. I told you that if we could do a whole season dedicated to Blair Witch, that I would try to get one of the original guys on. I do have to say thank you to Ben Rock, because Ben told me if I asked our guest, Mike Manello, to come on, that he would, and he did.
Oh, yeah, he did. And I would like to say that we actually both pushed him quite far, I think.
Yeah, he just naturally came and brought his interviewing shoes with him. You'll see that here in a second. We discuss a lot. We discuss, obviously, his favorites in horror. We discuss Blair Witch and everything leading up to it and following. We discuss his work with Campfire LLC, which I hadn't really heard a whole lot about, except for when I researched him, but they had their fingers in a lot of pop culture stuff.
Yeah, like I was really, really, like, I was blown away.
Yeah. And then make sure you stick around to the very end, just to tease this already, but we did talk about Video Palace. For those of you who don't know, Mike is the co-creator of it. And we pushed him about what the potential future for the series might be. So definitely listen to it. If you like what you hear, reach out to Shudder, tell them to get off their feet and give these people their money to make more.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm just really excited for you guys to hear it. So,
all right. Well, that's a perfect way to say sit back, relax, and enjoy the Here's Johnny interview with Mike Manello. Everyone, to a very special interview episode with Mike Manello.
Hello.
Hi. So for those of you who don't know, Mike, how I know about him is he produced the Blair Witch Project. And as I started diving more and more into you and your career, I found there's a lot of other stuff I liked that you were a part of. Namely, Video Palace.
Oh, fantastic.
And I don't sure if you remember this, but I was actually introduced to you at Sundance this year by Ben.
Oh,
it was at the end of the screening. Yeah, it's fine. It was very late. It was like 2:30 in the morning. I was not
ridiculous.
I wasn't even very much awake at that time. I had to drive home, so that was fun. But like always, when we have a new person on, we want to kind of get to know their horror bona fides. So, Mike, if you're ready. The first question we ask everybody.
I have a feeling I'm going to fail this, but go ahead.
What is your favorite scary movie?
Todd Browning's Freaks.
Oh, nice. Why is that?
I love the outsider nature of it. Well, first of all, I'm obsessed with that kind of sideshow era. Okay. I'm obsessed with the history of Coney Island. I think there's amazing stories in there, and the sideshows are a part of it. And that whole period of Americana, there's something very transgressive about it and obviously very wrong about it. But at the same time, it's very compelling to me. And Freaks was a movie that I had heard about for many, many years. See, I got my movie education working in a video store, right? And so, all those old VHS films, I watched all of them. And I remember when I finally got access to Freaks, after years of reading about this film and hearing about it, I watched it and it kind of surpassed my expectations in terms of it being really, truly a terrifying movie. You know, the fact that it used real sideshow performers was kind of the original reason I wanted to watch it. But just everything about it is so terrifying to me. It still scares the hell out of me today.
And not only that, it's even very culturally significant too. I mean, Scorsese had that bit in Wolf of Wall Street, calling back to it. Obviously very different genres, but I mean, it just still shows that years later it still has like a spot in the American psyche.
I
like Freaks a lot too. That's on our master list, so hopefully we'll get to it.
Yeah, hopefully, because I've never seen that movie. Never even heard of it. Yeah.
It's amazing. I mean, you can understand why people at the time were completely scandalized and why it went through periods of being banned. You know, it's I don't know. For me, it's a movie. You still have to watch it in the context of its time, but it's a movie that holds up. The other one is Spider Baby.
I have not heard of that one.
Neither have I.
Oh, no. Jack Hill. So it's kind of a horror comedy, actually. Okay. But it's a completely bizarre movie. You know, when Quentin Tarantino released Jack Hill's Switchblade Sisters on okay. DVD, that kind of made me interested to go chase him down. And I finally saw Spider Baby at a drive-in movie awesome. In Florida, drive-in theater in Florida, and it's still to this day one of the most bizarre movies I've ever seen, and it's kind of funny. And it's uncomfortably, it's uncomfortable and it's funny and it makes you feel physically uncomfortable, which is kind of why I think of it as like a horror movie in that way. But yeah, it's pretty wild. I don't want to spoil anything, but you've got to check out Spider Baby.
So the next question then, do you have a favorite horror novel?
Oh boy, a favorite horror novel. I don't know that I can point to a specific novel. I love Stephen King. I love Edgar Allan Poe. I will say that when people ask me about my favorite horror anything or a seminal one in my life, I actually point to a record came out in 1975, and it's called Famous Ghost Stories with Scary Sounds, and it was on a British label called Pickwick. And so, you know, 75, I got this when I was very young. I have no idea who gave it to me. It's a series of stories with some sound effects. But the narrator is kind of brilliant. And the story, Edgar Allan Poe's Telltale Heart, the version of that, it's on YouTube. You can actually look it up. But the version of Telltale Heart in particular captured my imagination. And I listened to that track in particular obsessively. And then I kind of read Edgar Allan Poe, but that was kind of my entry into horror, was actually in an audio format, ironically enough. But it was that whole record actually had kind of urban legends retold. It had story, it had, you know, Headless Horseman, Washington Irving, it had the Edgar Allan Poe, and had some other things, famous works and lesser known works in there. But the stories and the kind of style of storytelling in there really, really captured my imagination in horror. And I think that's where I got that sense of, like, I'm generally not a fan of the super visceral, extreme horror, unless it's so over the top, like Sam Raimi.
Yeah. You
know? Yeah.
but I'm not a fan of the super realistic kind of gore. It has to be, it has to be over the top for me. And, But these records are ones that kind of stuck with me for a long time. And it's because I imagined it, you know, like listening to this rendition of the Telltale Heart and the spare sound effects, like the beating heart and whatnot, was just absolutely terrifying. I still own that record and I play it every so often.
It's actually really funny that you say that. One of the things that got me into horror when I was a kid, it was around the same time actually where I first watched Blair Witch and The Faculty. It was all pretty much the same year, but around Halloween time, the radio station in my hometown played Orson Welles' War of the Worlds.
Nice.
And it was just so cool. And it's funny you say that, because I do attribute that to one of the things that got me in loving horror, was that being able to sit back, close your eyes, and just listen to a story. So I can definitely understand that.
Yeah. That record is one that I absolutely treasure. You know, it's like one of those things where if I ever get a scratch on it, and it's amazing to me that I listened to it as many times as I did as a kid, no less, and it doesn't have scratches, although it's really dirty. It's the kind of thing where if I got a scratch on it, I would immediately run to eBay and buy another copy.
So do you still have a copy of it?
I do. I have my original copy that even has like some of the scribbles I made on the jacket.
That's amazing. <Wow.
laughs> Good, yeah. It still plays and everything.
So with that, do you have a favorite horror TV show?
A favorite horror TV show. You know, it's interesting. I've been watching, I've most of my horror watching these days actually is I'm watching it with my youngest daughter, who's turning out to be a bigger horror fan than I am. And so I'm revisiting a lot of, we're watching more films than TV shows. But I've been watching some. So we watched what was this? Oh boy, I'm forgetting the name. But there was this Stephen King inspired
Castle Rock.
Castle Rock, which I thought was kind of interesting, an interesting experiment. And
I would agree with that. That's a very nice way of saying that.
Yeah. And we've watched, we've been watching Sabrina, The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, which is kind of lightweight, but also at the same time, kind of shockingly deep in the whole Satanism thing. Which,
really? I haven't gotten to it yet. Do you like it?
Oh, yeah. Well, I enjoy watching it with my daughter. I don't know that I'd watch it on my own, but okay. But what's funny is, as someone who was raised, is a totally lapsed Catholic, but who was raised Catholic, the satanic elements in the series are ones that still I find myself kind of going, ooh, like, you know, kind of reacting to in a visceral way from my upbringing, which I find interesting, because I've never seen a show go that deeply into like the idea of satanic masses and worshiping Satan and so on and so forth.
The Church of Satan too, right? Wasn't that like a big deal? Like the Church of Satan in the United States sued them?
Oh, I don't know. But I love
I think they actually brought a lawsuit because they used symbols or something.
Oh, that's funny. They should have, I mean, how hard could it have been to get permission? They should have used the statue, the Baphomet.
Yeah, they probably would have let them. They probably could have come on the set. All right, so next question. Your favorite horror monster. It doesn't have to be like one of the universal guys. Like mine personally is Michael Myers, and Justin's is the creature from It Follows. So you got a wide spectrum there.
Yeah. Mine is the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Perfect. Why is that?
Yeah. You know, he's the one that always kind of creeped me out, the way he looked. And I went through a phase when I was young where I was kind of obsessed with 3D movies. And, and all I had, you know, I couldn't watch them at the time because the technology didn't exist in 3D, at least, unless I found a screening, which I eventually did. But I would see stills, and I had all these 3D books. They had stills from Creature from the Black Lagoon. And those stills were always to me like, whoa, you know, with his hands reaching out of the screen and everything. Mm-hmm. So I just, for a long time, I only knew this creature from these kind of 3D, these kind of weird, janky red and blue 3D images. And when I saw the movie, I just love the way he looks. Well, wait, also, I should say it was filmed in Florida, in an area that I knew because I grew up in Florida, too. So there's that aspect. Like, he's a creature from the area, you know, the area where he swims and where the movie takes place looks very much like where I grew up.
So I have a quick question. Speaking of your obsession with 3D, did you ever seek out to find like a screening of Friday the 13th? I think it was part 2 or part 3.
Part 3
in 3D.
Yeah, I actually owned a 3D head system that kind of looks like what today we would think of as VR glasses, but it was like a head mounted 3D thing, and I had a bootleg DVD of it in 3D. Yeah. That and like Parasite with Demi Moore and Rottweiler. A bunch of those really awful 3D movie Crawl, you know, all those 3D movies from the 80s, the ones that when they came back. Yeah.
What did you think of Guillermo del Toro's kind of modern romantic take on the creature?
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it, but you know, I really like del Toro. I mean, I did think it was kind of, It's not a movie that I would go back to, but I enjoyed seeing it.
Yeah. Okay. Perfect. And then the last question, before we get into more about you.
Yeah.
It is, what is your least favorite trend in horror? So just for example, mine is torture porn. And Justin, this might bother you, but Justin's is found footage.
Doesn't bother me at all. I would have to say torture porn is a genre for me that's like, just I don't even go near.
Yeah,
there's nothing interesting in that to me at all.
Yeah, the one thing for me when it comes to torture porn, it's kind of hard, and we discussed it a little bit too, is that we both really like Saw, and Saw is one of those films that's given credit to bringing the rise to it, but if you go back and actually watch that, there's not a whole lot in there.
Yeah,
in the first
installment, yeah.
In Wands, yeah, in Jane Wands. It gets crazy, but at first there's not a whole lot in there, so I always thought that was really weird. Like, do you like the original Saw? Is that enough for you to enjoy?
Yeah, I don't mind it. I think, you know, if you were going to ask me about a trend, I think it's this trend of, like, of sequelizing everything
in the
same way and just making it more extreme, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I have no patience for the modern day remakes of movies that are just more gory. Like, I know a lot of people like the Evil Dead remake, but not.
Oh, you didn't like that?
No. And, you know, there's like the Poltergeist remake. No.
Well, I didn't know that existed.
Yeah. Oh, well, good.
Yeah, but, I did like the Evil Dead remake, and I'm actually a really big opponent for remakes and all that stuff. But I liked it because it stayed true to Raimi's idea of the gore, right? The over-the-top gore. And I thought it was true enough to the original material, but it also brought something different to the table. I don't know. And I like Jane leaving, so maybe that's part of it, too. I don't know.
Yeah. I think for me, like, Evil Dead 2 was, like, another big, big movie. And then that's how I discovered Raimi, and I went backwards. So those movies are kind of, I think I was imprinted with those movies early on, so that a remake maybe has a different effect on me.
Perfect. Yeah, I mean, because I've definitely seen Evil Dead, and I've gone to the play a couple times, too. So I'm familiar with it.
Yeah, the musical? You're talking about the musical?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, I saw it when it was on Off-Broadway.
Did you really?
Time. Oh, yeah.
That's amazing. Were you close enough to get splattered?
Oh, yeah. I was in the splash zone.
Love it. That's great. Jess, have you gone to see it yet?
So I actually saw it for the first time 10 years ago, it first came to Canada. And then I actually went 2 years ago. Just I figured out, you know what, I wonder what's changed in 10 years kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. It was a lot bloodier.
I loved it. I didn't tell my fiance about the splash zone. So we sat there.
Yeah. it was amazing to me that it was like that. And then in the same theater, I saw Toxic Avenger, the musical.
My God. I am so jealous right now. I remember reading about it in a paper like a week after it had just ended.
Oh, yeah. That was fantastic. Well, I wish they
was it good? Like,
I mean, it was a long time ago. But I remember just loving it and having a great time. But then again, you know, those trauma films were also
a product of their time, maybe.
a product of the time, but also a bit of an inspiration, you know. Yeah. Like, again, trauma films were coming out in the VHS era, and, you know, just the attitude that that trauma had of just, you know, hey, we're doing it our own way. And, you know, he's still like that, which is amazing. And then when I worked in an art house theater after graduating college, we would book midnight movies occasionally, and we played Romeo and Juliet and some of those, you know, some of those trauma films, we played them at midnights, and I love that. So yeah, they're so seeing the you know, Toxic Avenger the musical was kind of great fun, but also, again, probably a bit of a nostalgia trip for me.
All right, that's awesome. So I guess with all that, you passed the horror bona fide test. Congratulations. Okay. Obviously, Justin and I are aware of who you are, and probably some of our listeners are too, but why don't you just go ahead, like, introduce yourself, get a little bit of your background, like where you grew up and what got you into horror, where you went to school, and we can kind of go from there.
Yeah. So, my name's Mike Minello. I've had an unusual career path. I've kind of bounced around to a lot of different things. I got into movies actually through Star Wars, I think, like most people my age. Completely obsessed with Star Wars, had all the toys, played with them incessantly, and thought I wanted to get into special effects when I was very young. And kind of held on to that. But, you know, I grew up in Florida, not in New York or Hollywood or any media center. And as I got older, it was kind of like, oh, you got to do something where you can make money and you don't know any media industries. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I went to school at the University of South Florida in Tampa for 2 years. And I just went in and said, well, I'm just going to go there because it's far enough away from home where my parents can't drop in on the weekend, but close enough that, like, on the major holidays like Thanksgiving and Christmas, I can go home. Mm-hmm. So literally that's how I chose it. And I took like experimental film classes there. I took horror and supernatural literature class there, you know, and I kind of started exploring, and that's when I realized I wanted to go to film school. But it was really feeling unattainable for me until it just so happens the state of Florida decided, you know, Universal Studios opened the theme park, but they also opened sound stages, and Disney was building sound stages. And so the state of Florida said, oh, we want to make Florida a production state. So they commissioned the state schools to open up a bunch of different film schools. And the University of Central Florida in Orlando was going to be modeled after the kind of independent style of filmmaking, where as a student, you had to buy your own film stock and you had to pay for your own movies, but you own them. The school didn't pay for them, but the school also didn't tell you where you could submit them and where you could show them and all that stuff. So whereas like FSU was kind of like the Hollywood model, where, you know, they make a big thesis film and you apply for positions on the film. Or University of Florida, which was kind of more focused on documentary, or the University of South Florida, where I was, which was focused on kind of personal and experimental filmmaking. So I hoofed it over to Orlando and got into the first year of the film program, which was a restricted program. It was only supposed to be 30 students a year. It was meant to be 60 students total, but since we were the first year, we were 30 students that were let in. Okay. So it was like twice, you know, more equipment than students that first year. And that's where I met Ed and Dan. So Ed and Dan and I were in that first year's film program. The movies that inspired me, though, I was really wide ranging in my takes. Like, I didn't obsess over genres. I got more into filmmakers. So it's like, you know, the key filmmakers, Coppola, Scorsese, Woody Allen, believe it or not, was a big one, changed my idea of what you could do in movies, because, you know, some of his films like Annie Hall are formally structured so weird.
Oh, yeah.
So unusual. You know, but also, but I was, but I watched a lot. Jonathan Demme, I think, was an important filmmaker for me. Seeing something like Stop Making Sense and how it was like a concert film, but it carried a narrative in it was kind of eye opening.
And Danny then directed Silence of the Lambs, correct?
Yes, he directed Silence of the Lambs. But at the time, it would have been, for me, it was like seeing something wild in the theaters. So he directed Melvin and Howard, which is an amazing film with Paul LaMatte and Mary Steenburgen. And then Something Wild is, if you've never seen it, with Ray Liotta. It's the first time I ever saw Ray Liotta on screen.
Oh,
and his performance is astounding. I can't. Something Wild is a film that does something successfully that most films who have tried it fail miserably at, which is that it starts off in one genre and then at a certain point, bam, it turns into something completely different.
It's called Something Wild by Demme. Something
Wild, yeah, Jonathan Demme. Film. Melanie Griffith is in it. Great soundtrack. And then there was, you know, Married to the Mob. And then, of course, Silence of the Lambs, which was a huge one. By then, I was already in college and a huge Demme fan. But I love the way Jonathan Demme kind of, like, whatever genre he's playing in, it still kind of feels like Jonathan Demme, to me at least. So I got to learn these filmmakers and I got to kind of explore their entire careers, because I worked in this video store and I would bring home a stack of tapes, you know, every night, bring them back, more tapes than I could possibly watch, you know.
Justin's a veteran of Blockbuster.
I am. Yeah.
I think Blockbuster put the mom and pop that I used to work at out of business. Our store actually had an adult section behind a curtain.
Oh, you know? The curtain. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, we had that. And, it was when I first got a job there, I was young. I was still in high school, so they wouldn't let me return the tapes in that room. But I got the job because I proved my knowledge of films at the time, you know? So I wouldn't say at that time I had a favorite genre. I followed more filmmakers, but I saw a lot, and I saw a lot of, you know, B movies, older B movies, anything any filmmaker referenced. I saw a lot of foreign films. And so, like I said, I was pretty wide ranging, but truth be told, horror has never been kind of like a severe obsession of mine. And yet it's something I love. It's an area I love to work in. I kind of compare it to, like, you know, when you see an interview with like a heavy metal guitarist, and then they say their favorite artist is like some folk singer-songwriter or something. It's a little bit like that. Like, I love working in horror. I love making things that are going to scare people. But the movies themselves, outside of a few of a select kind of group, I tend to not generally go for, if that makes sense. So meeting Ed and Dan was kind of it was interesting because when you go to film school, you think, oh, I'm so talented, I'll do all these things. And then you slowly start to realize what you're good at and what you're not good at. And Ed and Dan were both guys who were much more evolved in their kind of their directorial skills, you know, the way they saw visual images come together. I realized I was much better as an editor myself. And so I got to know these guys because they were really, you know, Ed and Dan were like the top of the class in terms of, in my opinion, in terms of guys who came in and their student films showed a very sophisticated level of directing and filmmaking. And so we all became friends at film school. And I actually ended up in my last year working with Ed to co-produce and then co-edit with him his first feature film, which was a black and white drama called Gabriel's Dream. And so that was kind of solidified a working relationship for us. And then getting out of school, leaving film school, we all kind of went our separate ways. And I went to work selling TVs at Circuit City TVs.
Really?
And VCRs. Yeah, I sold like, you know, $800 camcorders, $700 VCRs, VHS VCRs. This was back when the job was a commissioned sales job, and like the people who worked there were, you know, raising families on the salaries they were earning at those gigs. And that was kind of an amazing job, actually, because it taught me a whole lot about sales and selling, which would later. So I went from that job. I heard about an opening at the Florida Film Festival in Enzian Theater, which is an art house cinema in Orlando. And I took a job selling tickets for the Florida Film Festival. And then the executive director, because it's a not-for-profit organization, invited me to stay on as their director of marketing, which was not a title that they had for a long time, to stay on. Because I took initiative in selling tickets and like going out there and trying to spread the word and basically not just sit there and wait for people to show up to sell, buy tickets from me.
That's awesome.
So I took that job, and on that job, I got to travel to film festivals because we would go scout films to see which ones we thought would do well in Orlando. I was responsible for doing everything from placing the ads to writing the press release for when films would open in Orlando and figuring out angles on how to sell them or how to create a story that the newspapers would pick up, arranging screenings for the critic in town at the paper, making flyers and distributing them to record stores and video stores and any cultural place where, you know, coffee shops, wherever we thought people would be interested in these films. And I learned a lot about the distribution and the films from the theater side, from like how the contracts are negotiated, how the money flows from the theater back to the distributor, all that, how film prints travel, how that whole back end works, which are things that you don't often learn in film school.
Yeah.
And I basically worked that job and stayed in communication. I would freelance as an editor sometimes. So like other people were involved in Ben, like in Blair Witch, like Ben Rock, I edited with him one of a short film he had, a commercial project. I with Dan got me a little gig at one point, editing videos for commercial videos for like a lot of theme restaurants that were opening up at the time that had video. Eventually we ended up doing a lot of videos for Planet Hollywood, actually. And a lot of the money that we earned there helped finance Blair Witch.
So
I was editing films at night or working in a record store, Peaches Records and Tapes, working in a record store and then working this day job at Enzian and the Florida Film Festival. And basically kind of doing that and figuring things out until, you know, Ed and Dan got together with Greg and said, hey, we think we're going to make that Woods movie idea we've been talking about since college, you know? And so I started helping them, as you do with friends, until I was officially kind of asked to join the team. And that's when I quit the job. I quit the low paying, not-for-profit film work to take the no paying independent film.
So I saw on IMDb, because that's how I get most of my research for these interviews, that you were part of Hacks and Films, and you were the producer for the Blair Witch Project, correct?
Yeah, so I my official title is co-producer, but I was, you know, I did a lot more than a traditional co-producer.
And that was my question, is so what was your role in the project? Like, how involved were you in, like, decision-making or marketing? Yeah. Or we're very, very curious. We can just roll right into Blair Witch. Like, what was your position? What was your job?
So I wish the jobs were clearly defined like that, because I think that quite a few of us have titles that don't reflect what we did, right? Like Ben Rock is production designer, but he was not really production designer.
That's
was
what a he title kind of that he got. Does too, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I came on officially. So I helped the guys. You know, I had a computer at the time. I, you know, the guys used my computer as the production computer back when, like, making the prospectus to try to raise money. I was basically, you know, helping wherever I could, just as a friend, until they came back with the footage that they had shot. So I was not officially on the film when they shot the footage in the woods. I was brought in officially when they came back with the footage to come in and basically help see the project through the editing, post-production, and then the festival circuit, and basically what we were going to do with the film after. So in a way, I think it was like all the experience that I had had working at the Florida Film Festival and going to film festivals and learning about what you do with a film after you've made it were all the thing. I think were the key reason that Ed and Dan and ultimately Greg and Rob wanted me to come on board.
So speaking of film festivals, what was the reaction when you guys got into Sundance, like on the team side of things?
And what was the like steps leading in? Like how does one apply to Sundance? Like what did you guys do to get to there? And then once you got there, like what was the reaction?
Yeah. So that's a really good question. I will tell you that actually, so that first film that Ed made, Gabriel's Dream, that I was also co-producer and co-editor on, I worked hard when I was working at the Florida Film Festival to like, try to find a place for that movie, as did Ed and Neil and some of the other folks who worked on it, you know, submitting it to various film festivals. And, you know, it wasn't a successful movie. It got rejected from Sundance. And you apply just, you know, you basically fill out the application and apply. I mean, today, you use technologies like without a box. It's not hard. Anyone can do it as long as you film. But we had gotten rejected by Sundance, and you know, Ed was Ed is a Cuban American, mm-hmm. and I found a film program in Atlanta that was for minority filmmakers, and I submitted Gabriel's Dream because I thought it addressed a lot of the issues. You know, it was really came from Ed's experience working in kind of a blueprint factory, I guess you call it a factory, a blueprinting shop. With a bunch of guys. And so I submitted Gabriel's Dream and we went to this thing. And what was amazing about it was not really a festival. It was kind of more like a program where it was run by the cable company in Atlanta. And they brought kind of film experts down to talk to you about your film. And one of them was Jeffrey Gilmore, who was the executive director of Sundance.
Oh,
and
wow.
He came and he remembered our film because he had rejected it that year. and he remembered our film and he gave us this really great feedback about the film and about why it got rejected. And, you know, and it was fantastic. And so, and we submitted to Sundance basically the same way, just filled out the application and submitted it. But, you know, when we had our screening that night, that premiere night of the screening, Jeff Gilmore came out and he came up to Ed and I and he said, I'm really glad you guys kept, you know, he said to Ed specifically, I'm really glad you kept making films. And he remembered Gabriel's Dream. And I do think that there's an aspect to this idea of like, oh, like when they saw the film, at least Jeff and others knew that this was not the first film from at least Ed, you know what I mean? And that, I don't know if that had any effect or not. But I will say that there's a series of events that led up to us getting into Sundance, I think. Okay. And I can't say any of this definitive because you'd have to ask the people who actually selected the film.
Uh-huh.
But I can say that Blair Witch kind of started getting buzz in the industry in October. which is before Sundance announces their mm-hmm. film picks. And I don't want to say that they're swayed by buzz in their selections, but that's something that's not something most films have, you know, unless they're made by a studio.
Yeah.
And the reason for that was because of the online fan base that had built up from the website. And, you know, there were fans who were doing things like, there were two levels going on. There were fans that were doing things like calling up LA radio show, the Mark and Brian show in LA on Halloween when they were talking about Scary Stories. And a fan sat on hold for hours and then got on the air and said, "Have you guys heard about the Blair Witch?" And
really?
And then these DJs went to the website live on the air and started talking about the mythology and talking about the story. It crashed our site.
I never heard that story. That's awesome.
Yeah. And so, you know, this is like morning drive time radio on the most popular FM station at the time, all talking about Blair Witch as a movie, but nobody really knew it in LA, right? The heart of where like all the Sundance screeners are and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of thing started catching buzz. Now, in addition to that, Kevin Fox, one of our executive producers, showed the tape to a couple of people, showed it to Stuart Rosenthal, who was a part of a very high-powered law firm in LA, who signed on to be our lawyer. And in Hollywood, when somebody from the firm like that signs on to be a lawyer for a film that hasn't gotten into any festivals or something, it kind of creates a buzz on the business side of things. And then the second thing was that he showed it to Endeavor, which today is, you know, WME, right? William Morris Endeavor. But at the time, they weren't part of William Morris. And he showed it to Endeavor, and the agents came to Florida to meet with us and sign.
Really?
Yeah. And they signed us on as agents. So that, plus we came to New York and we did a screening and we signed on Jeremy Walker as a publicist. And Jeremy Walker had been known for doing some big indie films at the time. So like all the while Sundance is making their decisions, we're building a team of people who are well known in the indie film space. Right. Okay. So I have to, you know, I have to imagine that there's some level of insider professional buzz happening from the back channels there of like, hey, this is a film that has some movement behind it. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, the things that the fans were doing online to basically get the word out for a film that, you know, they hadn't seen and wasn't yet finished, I'm sure had some influence on it. The other thing was that Sundance that year was looking to transform the midnight section.
Okay.
So the midnight section of Sundance was oftentimes like anniversary screenings of like films like John Waters' Pink Flamingos, which I adore. And I adore John Waters as a hero. But and they were looking to, or really, really bizarre kind of experimental films. And so they were looking to kind of transform the midnight section and make it more commercially viable. And I think they thought that Blair Witch might help do that, kind of set the motion for the midnight section being not a dumping ground for weird stuff, but actually something that the distributors would go seek out for films. So, you know, it was kind of, I think it was a perfect, like everything with Blair Witch, I think it was just a perfect storm.
Can you recall your reaction and the team's reaction when you got accepted into Sundance, when you found out?
Oh my gosh. Oh, it was huge. I mean, it was huge. I think we actually, you know, I think we actually went out a 6-pack of beer. It was all so we didn't get drunk. We just, you know, had a beer. A beer and a half or something. But yeah, it was it was pretty amazing, because that's the dream, right? That's the dream that you kind of don't allow yourself to think will actually happen. And so when it happens, you're kind of, oh my gosh. And it happened for us right before the Thanksgiving holiday. Oh, like awesome. Literally right, I think we got the call like Wednesday, and you know, like or Tuesday or Wednesday, like right before we were all gonna leave and go to either our families or whatever for Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Which was kind of amazing news. And we couldn't talk about it. Like we couldn't tell anyone because they wanted us to keep it quiet because the announcement hadn't been made. Mm-hmm. But it was an amazing feeling. But I will say that we were also extremely fortunate, because the Los Angeles Independent Film Festival, which happened after Sundance, I had submitted the Blair Witch to that as well. And the programmer there saw the tape and immediately called us up and said, look, he's like, you're going to get into Sundance. It's crazy if you don't get into Sundance. This film's going to get into Sundance, he said. But if it doesn't, I want to offer you opening up my film, Los Angeles Independent Film Festival.
Oh, wow.
Which was
wow.
nothing to sneeze at. Obviously, that's a huge thing.
Yeah.
So I think the fact that we had that there, like, oh, my gosh, if we don't get into Sundance, we're going to premiere as the opening night film at the Los Angeles Independent Film Festival. That was something that kind of gave us a little bit of breathing space. But when when Sundance came in, it actually became like, oh, we got into Sundance. How amazing. And then it became like, wait a minute, should we play the midnight section or should we take the opening? You know, like, do you take the opening night of a festival that's not as big, but still very big?
Yeah.
Or do you play the midnight section, which is non-competitive? You can't win any awards or anything like that at Sundance. And ultimately it's
I didn't know you couldn't win any awards at the midnight section. I didn't know that.
I don't think I don't think even today the midnight section is competitive.
Oh, okay.
And I think, you know, at the end of the day, like, well, Sundance is where all the filmmakers that we were falling in love with were discovered. So, yeah. You know, went to Sundance. Yeah.
So you get to Sundance, you show your film amongst all these people. What was the reaction that night? And then how long until Lionsgate came up to you guys and the ball started rolling on the mainstream?
So, the film got booked into Sundance, and we really came into Sundance with a lot of buzz by that point. You know, people started seeing the website. They started seeing that there was fans already for the film. Fans started calling radio stations talking about Blair Witch. So the story was starting to pop up all over. And we show up at Sundance, and I had been to Sundance a couple of times before my previous job. So I knew the lay of the land there. And we went in pretty smart. So as producers who were looking to market the film, we set up as our goal. We said, look, our market right now is not the general public. Our market is actually the people who have the authority to buy films for the distributors.
Okay.
Like when you go to Sundance, that's your market. So we kind of felt like Blair Witch was such a weird movie. We said, strategically, we need to show that Blair Witch can be marketed like a horror film, right? Like,
yeah.
We need to show, because it's such a weird movie. So we had we had an incredible designer in Orlando. He's still in Orlando, Steve Carcella, and he works at Disney and Yellow Shoes. We went to him with a couple of tasks. One was put together a poster, but not a full-size one sheet, one that's, you know, smaller, because we knew that our poster was going to go into Windows. And we said, think about what that poster could be. Showed him the film. And then the other thing was, take the stick man and make a logo. Give us our Nike swoosh. It's like, you know, like, give us a logo, something. It's not a photo. It's a logo that can run in black and white, that can be embroidered on a hat or a shirt or anything. Basically something that can be an iconic logo for the film that would be seen as a marketing asset. And that, of course, is the logo you see on even the finished films from Artisan at the time. So, so we went into Sundance, and the other thing we did was we really looked at the lay of the land, and we said, okay, when you're at Sundance, it's like industry people, filmmakers make a couple of mistakes at the time. They would make one sheets, which are, you know, 27 by 41 posters, which no business would let you hang in their window because it dominates the whole window.
Yeah.
And then they would make t-shirts. Like, everybody likes t-shirts. They would make t-shirts, but it's Park City in the wintertime. No one's wearing exposed t-shirts. So we made ski caps with the Blair Witch logo and then the name of the film in the font that you see in the credits. And then we made silver pins. We actually had somebody make real silver, like jewelry pins.
Really?
Pins of the stick man. And we gave out the pins to people who were aware of the film and in the industry. So people like John Pearson, some folks, our agents, our lawyers. Basically, we wanted for people in the industry to be seen with the pin, and we wanted the pin to be seen, basically use it as an icon. Like, wanted people to see the Stickman logo everywhere and go like, wow. And it was all part of that strategy of like, look, this film can be marketed like a traditional horror film, even though it's not a traditional horror film. And so I think that was really an effective strategy. The other thing is that at the midnight screening, so we premiered the first weekend at midnight. Mm-hmm. And what was incredible is the midnight screening had sold out before the festival even started. And yet when we got there, you know, the way Sundance were, have you been to Sundance before?
This year's my first year. We went to the 20th showing of Blair Witch.
Oh, great. So we premiered in that same theater, the Egyptian Theater. Mm-hmm. And you know that alley with the side entrance there?
Oh, yeah. I stood there for a while. I was like second in line.
Oh, okay. Did you have a ticket or were you in the standby line?
Oh, no. I couldn't find it. And Ben was trying to, it's kind of a funny story. Ben was trying to help me like through Twitter DM to find tickets because I thought I missed it. And then my fiance surprised me as a birthday present that she already had two tickets to the showing.
Nice.
So,
fantastic.
It was pretty cool.
So at the time, and I don't know if they still do it this way, but at the time they would have like, they would sell a certain number of tickets. They had leave a certain number of seats open for badge holders. And mm-hmm. then they would sell standby tickets that were numbered. And then, you know, they would like 5 minutes before the film starts, they would count the number of empty seats and they would sell that number of standby tickets or 15 minutes before it starts. Right. Mm-hmm. To account for badge holders who were at other movies. So, we get there and the standby line is packed. That alley was packed. and which is unusual when you figure the film sold out so early that mm-hmm. everybody, and it was packed full of college and high school students. Now, college and high school students is not a group of people you normally see at a Sundance screening in Park City. Yeah. And not only that, but the film was being screened in Salt Lake City the next weekend. And that had not sold out. And so what that told us, you know, looking at that and knowing kind of how we book films and being able to read audiences in terms of like, what's this going to do?
Yeah.
Soon as I saw that, it was like we knew we had tapped into an audience for this film and that these people probably all come from Salt Lake City and they decided to drive up the mountain in the snow to try to get into the sold out screening because they wanted to see it first. Like,
yep.
That's something, you know, rather than just wait 1 week to the next weekend and see it in Salt Lake City, right? Where it was mm-hmm. going to screen. And so immediately kind of we understood and I talked to the guys and I said, look, if we don't get a certain amount of money offer for this film, we should turn it down. Because we can four-wall this theater. We could four-wall theaters and make the money back for our investors on our own. And we thought at a certain number, the equation flips and it's better for us and our investors to sell. Right?
Sure. Yeah.
But what was amazing about that is that gave us some bargaining power at the table. Because as independent first-time filmmakers trying to negotiate for a film, you have no bargaining power.
Yeah, but, I can only imagine.
We had a very little bit because there was a level at which it was too low, we were willing to walk away. Because we had seen that, because we knew what we were building, you know, online with the fan base. Mm-hmm. Which was really amazing and very organic. But it was kind of, for me, it crystallized something that like, that being in touch with the fan community actually wasn't just awarding to the ego. It was awarding in terms of like being able to bring, being able to leverage support for getting your work out there.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm not sure that I know for a fact the film would not have opened as wide without those fans, but I'm not even sure the film would have been bought at Sundance because it was a very, like, you look at the film now and it's hard to look at it from the day, but when Artisan, who bought the film back then and distributed it, they did a test screening in New Jersey. And it was like, you know, the screener asked a select group of people who stayed afterwards, like, what does this film remind you of? And nobody could name any other film at the time. In fact, nobody even mentioned Cops, which was probably the only reality TV programming, that and Real World on MTV, the first season. But, you know, Survivor didn't come on until after Blair Witch. Yeah. So reality TV programming was not a thing. And people didn't even know, like what genre to put this in. The words found footage weren't a thing then.
Yeah.
You know,
created it.
Yeah, well, it was right from the title card. So, you know, a year later or whatever, mm-hmm. years later, footage is found. But you know, it was an amazing event, and it was an amazing ability to kind of to work with a distributor who we knew was going to release the film. Because one of the things that was happening in the industry was that certain distributors, Miramax specifically, was notorious for paying a lot of money for films just to keep it out of their competitors' hands, and they would never distribute the films.
They would just sit on Entourage.
So, you know, we were very insistent on, like, part of our deal had to guarantee a certain certain kind of release. That's like, awesome. we wanted our film to be seen. So, you know, we ended up selling to Artisan, and it was funny because the executives at Artisan said they were very divided. They were very divided, and I remember Amir Malin, who was one of the co-presidents, told me that at one point they realized that the division was in the company was through age, and that all of the younger executives thought that Artisan was crazy to buy the film, and all the older executives were like, "We don't get it." And it was when they realized that the division was in an age division like that, that's when the older folks decided, "Yeah, we should get this film." And make an offer. So
obviously Blair Witch changed the landscape of horror, and it was a huge cultural phenomenon, and a ton of stuff spun off from it. Like, I know that Ben had the Curse of Blair Witch little mini thing. There was a bunch of book series. And for this season, like our 20th anniversary of Blair Witch, we're going to be playing the Curse of Rustin Parr. And according to IMDb, you had a hand in that?
Oh, you're talking about Curse of the Blair Witch?
No, Curse of the Blair Witch was what Ben did, right? There's a video game called Curse of Rustin Parr.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there and were
it,
three video
IMDb
games.
Said you were a part of it. Is that true?
Yeah, it was very loose. Very loose in terms of, like, you know, the those games were done very quickly, so they were based on pre-existing game engine. And was it really called The Curse of Rustin Parr?
Yeah, the first part was, anyways, yeah.
Yeah, there's three games. Do you know what the other two are called, Justin?
The Legend of Coffin Rock and the Ellie Kedward Tale was part three.
But Blair Witch Volume 1 was Rustin Parr, Blair Witch Volume 1, Rustin Parr, yes. From Terminal Reality. It was, you know, those games were kind of like, because those games were made at a time when we were really focused on getting the film out there, we were only involved in as much as, like, you know, basically handing over the Bible to them and then kind of reading their story ideas and kind of feeding back on them. Okay. And then looking at early versions and feeding back on them. But really, I think our attitude was like, these guys make games. Let's not muck around. They needed to happen quick. So they were kind of built on engines and some pre-existing resources.
Sure.
That came out there, and we just wanted them to be a part of the mythology, even if they weren't the definitive telling of those mythologies. We kind of wanted to maintain that urban legend feel, so that we wanted them to kind of follow the general mythology, even if they kind of went off and took their own kind of flights away from it.
So it's 20 years later, Blair Witch, at least in a lot of people's eyes, is still seen as seminal. It's still seen as this film that changed just the way horror was presented and the way horror went forward, along with the viral marketing and everything else that went along with it. A lot of stuff has happened that some people aren't fans of. Blair Witch, Book of Shadows comes to mind. And I kind of liked the 2016 Blair Witch film. I know it has its detractors, and it definitely doesn't have that same magic as the original. But I guess as one of the people who was there from the beginning, saw this baby that they made and what it turned into, 20 years later, where do you stand on the franchise, and like, what are your thoughts on it? In particular, the Blair Witch Project.
Okay.
A lot there, I know. I'm sorry.
No. It's good. I've got to choose my words wisely. I can tell I'm only going to speak with regards to Blair Witch 2 Book of Shadows.
Okay.
I'm not going to represent anybody else's point of view. I'm only going to represent mine.
Okay.
Because I don't want to put any words in other people's mouths. But I suspect that my feeling was generally was close. Okay. I was not a fan of the way that Artisan wanted to make it, which was essentially to come talk to us in like November and say, "Hey, we did a survey at a mall in Pasadena, and it turns out if we make a Blair Witch sequel that's in theaters this next October for Halloween and has and is not shot, you know, not found footage or not handheld, but shot like a traditional movie and has an attractive young cast and shows some supernatural gore, that it'll make 75% of the box office that the first one made. So what do you think?" It was like kind of like practically presented in that way. And we were like, we think that it's too late to make a movie for Halloween. Mm-hmm. That's not the right movie. I think we had ideas for a next movie that I think would have been actually amazing and would have been fairly groundbreaking as a franchise, because and to a certain extent my heart was broken when I saw The Witch, because The Witch is actually very much like the movie I think we thought we could make after Blair.
I love The Witch. That breaks my heart.
The idea was to go all the way back to the Ellie Kedward story and break what you think you know about it, but tell the story. And Ed used to use the reference of Kubrick's Barry Lyndon. Like, he wanted it shot like with candlelight, and we didn't want big stars, and we didn't want everybody looking pretty and movie star like, you know, we wanted to feel, but it was going to be a traditional movie. But of course, it was going to be a period piece as well. But it was isolated in the winter, so you know, I don't think it would have. I think it could have been done. It could have been done. It couldn't have been done for the next Halloween. It would have required the Artisan to say, "Yeah, we're going to do that. We'll sit on it and not have anything out in the Halloween." But you know, they wanted to bust a movie out that was going to make 75% of what the first movie made, at least according to their research. And so, you know, yeah, we didn't own it, you know, as filmmakers who didn't have a lot of power, all we had was what you call the right of first refusal, which means they had to come to us to ask us if we wanted to do it. And so we said no. And whether that's, whether we should have gone and said, "Hey, this is our baby and this is what they want to do. Let's try to make the most of it." Whether that was that would have been a smarter move, I can't say. I think I've heard from people that they thought we should have, you know, play the game and get your movie made. I don't think there was any successful movie to be made as a sequel to Blair Witch at that time. I just think that culturally it had been overexposed. I think the backlash had as much to do with that overexposure as it did to people's actual reactions to the movie. It was just too popular and it was everywhere. I mean, you know, I think we were all sick of Blair Witch by the time, you know, it was still playing in theaters. Like, I remember it came out in DVD in October and it was still playing in some theaters. So, you know, and it had come out in July. So, I just think, and you know, it had been on the cover of Time and Newsweek at the same week. It was like, it was huge, I think, culturally. And so people just needed a rest, and Artisan just wanted to push it forward. And so they went with another filmmaker, and, you know, we read the script and we told them right off the bat, we said, "This is not going to be successful." And they said, "Why?" And we said, because it does not adhere to the mythology. That's the reason fans love this property. Like, there's a mythology and this film breaks that mythology. And they were, and you know, I think the filmmaker who made it was kind of like, "Well, this is my story that I want to tell. And so thanks for your opinion. Goodbye." And that's essentially, you know, what happened. So I can't look at that film with clean eyes. You know, to me, that film is just should not exist. Now, I don't want to say it's a bad film or a good film. It's the film that filmmaker wanted to make. I mean, I know there've been a lot of talk about the Artisan interference and forcing him to put stuff in there. But I got to tell you, I read the script. I don't think the film as it was, I think the film was faulty at the core of it, simply did not deliver on the mythology. And I think you can make any kind of film in the world. Like, the original idea for the franchise was that we might make a black and white 1940s kind of crime mystery out of the Rustin Park story. You know, so the idea for the franchise wasn't it's all found footage. The idea for the franchise was it's going to explore this myth using a variety of filmmaking styles and genres that make sense for the story. And the original Blair Witch for the era that it took place in was the right story was video cameras and handheld and, you know, that kind of film student style, because that's what a lot of people were doing at the time, the way rough and tumble low budget films were being made. So I'm still in love with the original idea for the franchise. I don't think it'll ever get revived. You know, Artisan, Artisan went out of business, and Lionsgate owns it now, and Lionsgate is managing the franchise the way they see fit. I know they've had conversations with Ed and Dan, but, you know, I know they had conversations before the 2016 Blair Witch. Okay. So, you know, I just think, here's my take. I think there's a lot of things that can be done with Blair Witch, but I think that there's something special that the original creators brought to it that I think is going to be very, very hard for any other filmmaker to come in and step in and understand. And I think I'm not blowing smoke up Ed and Dan's behinds, but it wouldn't occur to me to produce a Blair Witch without them. You know what I mean? Another one without them, just because I do think that, you know, when you were asking earlier about our roles and our positions, we all contributed a lot of different ways. Like, we had key roles and key things we were in charge of, but, you know, it was kind of like a, you do whatever needed to be done kind of thing too. And so, Greg in particular had a lot of influence in the way the finished film came out. And Rob and I, you know, we were looking at cuts and we were having big discussions with Ed and Dan. We had to make the decision whether the film should be a traditional documentary like Curse of the Blair Witch, which Curse of the Blair Witch is actually the original idea for the film, the way that's structured.
Oh, really?
The film was never going to be a total found footage film like that.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, like the editing process was like, okay, all this footage came back from the shoot. And I think the idea was really to just get maybe 15, 20 minutes of usable footage from the woods. And so it was like, okay, Ed and Dan sat down and said, we're going to take this footage and we're going to string a chronological cut of what happened in the woods that we'll then use to edit the parts that were, take the parts we're going to take from, right? And so the idea was just cut out, you know, the duplicate takes, because there were duplicate takes and things, and do things like certain scenes like the house at the end and other sequences were shot multiple times and string together the best versions of each of those and string it together. And then let's see what works and what doesn't. And then we'll take the best scenes from that. And what happened is it's strung together. And then we decided to do a screening to people who were not familiar with the film in Orlando at the Enzian Theater where I used to work. And we did this screening in the day. We asked our friends to invite people who don't know us because we didn't want people to blow smoke up our behinds, just for sure, telling us they loved it when they didn't. And so we screened the film. And what's funny is actually the title card, Ed wrote the title card for that screening just to give what the people were going to see context. So even that title card originally was really just because we didn't have any of the what we call phase two foot shot, the documentary stuff. Okay. We hadn't shot any of it. We just wanted to see what was working because we were all too close to the footage. Mm-hmm. But we didn't do a good job of explaining that to people. We wanted to just unspool the film and see what their reaction was, mostly to scenes. We thought we were going to get feedback on scenes. And instead, people were giving us feedback as if that was the finished film or that was what the film was going to be. But even coming away from that, we still were like, well, we still got to cut away. We got to start shooting phase two. And so a lot of the stuff that's in Curse of the Blair Witch was actually shot to be in Blair Witch Project.
Oh,
right. Yeah.
Really cool.
Yeah. And so, but as we started cutting the film down, it was like every time we cut away from Heather, Mike and Josh in the woods, the energy of the film just dropped. You know what I mean? Like it just lost it. And it was like, oh, it's not working. And there was so much good stuff there that, you know, it was decided, we actually started, and the guy started making two different versions, one with the footage in it and one with the footage without. And we were going to look at both and decide. And we ultimately obviously decided without. Yeah. But yeah, so if you look at Curse of the Blair Witch, it's like Curse of the Blair Witch looks more like what the original idea for Blair Witch Project was. And so that title card ended up staying because that's all we had to give context to the footage of the film, which I think Ed might have refined the copy on. But I think one of the reasons Blair Witch works in ways that other films that are made as found footage is that because that footage in the woods was never designed to be an entire film, mm-hmm. the things that some people find problematic with it, like this, there's not really a lot of story. It sags. It goes, it meanders the way, you know, it feels very, very real in that way, that the story doesn't follow a traditional narrative structure the way that you expect, because it wasn't designed to be seen as in its entirety that way. And so as a result, I think that that lends the film, that gives the film that kind of realism that I'm not even sure Ed and Dan would have given it had they thought that everything being shot in the woods was what was going to be make the final film. Because as storytellers, you're kind of like, you find yourself wanting to impose more structure on, even in a, you know, even in a film where you know it's supposed to be found footage. Whereas Blair Witch actually is found footage in the sense that, you know, the whole film is made up of footage that we were not really expecting to have.
That's so crazy. Cool. All right, Justin, go ahead. You've been waiting. Go ahead.
Yes. All right. Excellent. So obviously this past June, we got a lovely surprise trailer for a new Blair Witch game. Did you have like, were you like shown anything from it? Were you kind of like brought in for anything? Was anybody talked to anybody about it, or was it just kind of like, was it a surprise for you as well?
The first I heard of it was when people started pinging me on Twitter and Facebook. Okay. Saying,
I was probably one of those people. I'm sorry.
No, that's great. And then, I pinged Ed and was like, have they told you about this? And he's like, I heard rumblings that it was being made. But, you know, so, yeah, we didn't really have any involvement in that. And I kind of honestly, I hope it's a great game. I really do. Because I hate to see the franchise die out with these things. But at the same time, when I hear them announce that it's going to be canon, I kind of go in my head, I kind of think, yeah, I know you own the franchise, but honestly, I feel like unless Ed and Dan do it, you know, unless it comes from the original makers, it's not canon. They can say whatever they want, but yeah.
Because we had heard that too, and we were curious if you had any inside knowledge of maybe you guys had.
You know, look, and hey, maybe it is. You know, maybe when the story comes out, Ed and Dan might go, hey, that's kind of cool, you know. But, you know, look, the whole thing about the whole thing about sequels, things that take place after the Blair Witch, is that the Blair Witch myth kind of goes away and then doesn't come back for another, 55 to 60 years,
mm-hmm.
right, if you look at it. So it's like, technically, if you want to make a sequel to Blair Witch, you've got to set it, you know, 50 plus years after Blair Witch Project, you know, if you want to stay true to the mythology.
That's,
you know, that's just something that's there. So, yeah, I kind of, you know, I appreciate the 2016 Blair Witch, I appreciate it. But again, I don't think I can see it with clear eyes.
Well, even to your point, I think you had a great point that like that wasn't the original intention of the franchise. Like, you guys didn't want to make found footage what Blair Witch was. You wanted to do something different with any sequels that were to come off. And I mean, I didn't know that before, but knowing that now, that, like I said, what could have been?
Yeah. I, in some ways, I wish maybe we had been smarter about how to make that happen in Hollywood.
You were kids. What did you
expect? Well, you know, we were all about 30.
Were you really? I thought you were all younger than that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, I just gave away my age. No, we were all about, you know, hovering around 30. I think we'd all kind of crossed that barrier.
Okay.
That 30-year-old. Yeah, I mean, you know, you got to remember, we graduated film school. Ed had made a film. We all went our separate ways for several years. And then kind of came back together and made Blair Witch. So, like, Greg had gone off to LA and was working as a set dresser on like Mad TV. Ed had gone back to Maryland and was trying to do stuff and, you know, was making web pages in Maryland. Dan was here in Orlando. He was getting a job as an editor and he was feeding me freelance gigs. You know, and Rob was like doing, you know, Golf Channel promos and things like that. So, you know, here in Orlando. So it was kind of like we were all, you know, we were all kind of trying to make our own things happen in our own different ways. And then we just kind of came, you know, this film, this the idea for this film that Greg, that Ed and Dan had, it was so strong. It was strong enough to bring us back together to go, yeah, you know, I think we believed in it when we heard it. The hook was so strong, this idea, you know, originally when I heard the pitch from Ed, it was imagine these kids in the 70s take a Super 8 camera and go out in the woods to shoot this legend and they disappear and then their Super 8 footage is found, you know, years later, and you make a movie about that and you have like, you have the footage and then you have like experts from Kodak verifying that the Super 8 footage was indeed from that era and could not have been faked, and you know, all this stuff, and the inspiration was kind of like the show In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was the original pitch. And then from then on, it became like, oh, what an incredible hook. We should do that. We called it the Woods movie. We should do that Woods movie, you know, but it was the kind of thing where, yeah, but we're all trying to graduate film school and we're making our short films and stuff. And then we all went our separate ways. And then, you know, it kind of came back as we should do that. Yes, we really should.
So kind of speaking of the fact that you guys used to call it the Woods, is that have anything to do with, isn't that what the 2016 film was like secretly filmed under? It was like the Woods.
Yeah. Yeah. I think they called it the Woods. We just called it the Woods movie because it was short. Like it didn't have a, you know what I mean? There was like the mythology hadn't been built out. It hadn't, you know, it was just kind of like as a concept, it just sat there, but it was so strong. It was such a strong concept, and it was a strong concept because it took all the things that are challenging about making independent films, right? You don't have access to name actors. You don't have access to big cameras. You don't have access to lights and large crews and all those things. And you look and you go, the idea for Blair Witch actually takes all of those things that are normally a hindrance and turns them into a benefit, right? Because if Blair Witch Project had been made by a known filmmaker and had a celebrity that you were familiar with,
you wouldn't have bought in.
Even if it was shot the same way, you never would have bought into it. You never would have had that sense of immersion. And so all the things that are normally negatives about independent films became strengths with Blair Witch.
Yeah. All right. So one last question on Blair Witch and we'll move on. But like I mentioned, like Blair Witch is one of my top two favorite horror films ever. I mean, I credit it to so much for me growing up and this my love of horror and just a bunch of stuff. So I'm just curious, is there ever a chance that you and Ed and Ben and all the guys who helped create this project are going to get back together and do something again? Like maybe not Blair Witch related, but just try to repeat the magic from 20 years ago.
Personally, I would love that. I don't know if it would happen. I would making that film was one of the most satisfying creative experiences of my life. Like, you know, the idea of being in sync. I feel like for the most part, we were all in sync about what we were doing and we were all working towards the same thing. And it was really about nothing more but like, let's just make this amazing thing. Let's make it as great as we can and experiment, you know, that same kind of wild experimentation. Like I would want to do it, but I would want to do it without the like, you know, I'd want to do it if we all felt like, hey, we could throw caution to the wind and we can truly experiment again and be willing to take chances. Cause I think a big part of it was that for me. Like when I look at the work I've done, you know, at Campfire and after, a lot of it is done with expectation set when you're given money. I would love to work on something where I feel like we could be like, this is incredible. Let's do it the way it should be done and not have anybody tell us we can't do it a certain way. that would be a dream. Now, whether that happened, I can't say, but you know, I personally would love to see the Blair Witch franchise come back in a way that I think is truly kind of authentic and worthy and frankly not found footage. I just don't think that's in the cards.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Just for time's sake, we're going to skip Audie and Altered and go into Campfire. Is that okay?
You bet.
Yeah, I didn't realize we've been talking for an hour and a half. It's something all on Blair Witch.
You're going to have a lot of editing to do.
Okay, so jump forward 20 years. Today, you are a co-founder of Campfire LLC, correct?
Yes,
Campfire. Will you kind of break down what that is for our audience and what you guys are involved with?
Yeah, so Campfire is kind of an unusual marketing agency. We work with mostly entertainment companies, largely television, but sometimes studios, sometimes game companies, and sometimes brands. And we create kind of immersive narrative experiences across any channel, whether it's digital, whether it's video, whether it's experiential, you know, physical. Mm-hmm. Campfire has its roots in Blair Witch, and that whole, like I told you, you know, the website and the community that built around the website was very organic, and it was something that, you know, I had been involved online for many, many years. I put the Florida Film Festival and Enzian Theater online at a time when websites were so new that launching our website was actually front page business section of the Orlando Sun. You know what I mean? So like we're talking about early internet days, and so I think Ed and I in particular were kind of right time. We were surfing the internet and figuring that out at the right time when it was easy and approachable, and we're in dial-up modems. And I had put up a website, so I understood about some aspects of like building community for Enzian and creating email newsletters and things like that, right? And okay. So when we started putting the Blair Witch site together, and we started doing Hacks and News as an email newsletter and doing all of that work, and then building community and like seeing the community and reacting to the community and creating more on the web in relation to what fans online were talking about. That was an incredible experience. I love that. I actually love that more than the process of making films, traditional films, producing films. And so I wanted to do it, and we all wanted to do it. And we pitched a lot of things around Hollywood that were kind of website and film or website and TV connected. And not a lot of it went anywhere because Hollywood was still kind of like, oh, that website, that's marketing. We'll talk about that later. They didn't really want to invest in it. But brands and ad agencies were very interested in what we did because all they want is attention from people, right? Brands, they just want attention because they want to sell something. And so they didn't need us to figure out their business model. Their business model was they spend money and they want people to pay attention. And so they started coming to us and saying, hey, you know, can you take what you learned from Blair Witch and maybe help us figure something out online? Mm-hmm. And so all of us kind of did a little bit of work in that area, but Ed and I then with a project called Beta 7, which was for NFL 2K4, Sega NFL 2K4, kind of finally got to take our ideas for like spinning a narrative online and in the real world and doing it over the course of 3 months with live kind of actors playing roles online. And that was very successful in the advertising industry. And okay. So these job opportunities kept coming, and it was like, oh, you want to pay me to basically experiment and do things that haven't been done before? Yes, I want to do that. And so Campfire was born out of that, and officially so we were working as a loose conglomerate of people. And then Greg and I and some other folks kind of formed Campfire officially like in 2006. And at that point it became like a real ad agency and we started working for clients, and I stopped working in movies to focus on building Campfire.
Okay.
So since then, we do a lot of work. We do a lot of work with HBO. We launched True Blood. We launched the first season of Game of Thrones.
Did you really?
Wow.
Yeah, we did. We did season one and worked on some season two for Westworld. We continue to work on Leftovers. We've done a lot of things with HBO. We have done some things with AMC. We recently worked on Nosferatu.
I just finished that book. I'm really excited to check out the first season now that it's all done. Yeah.
Oh, you'll like it. We've worked with Discovery Channel, done things on Shark Week. We get a lot of, we're asked to do a lot of horror. We worked, we did this amazing thing for Outcast with Cinemax, you know, the Robert Kirkman series.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Where it was a, it was kind of like an immersive, it was a we called it a interactive trailer, but it was really a story of your own possession. If you're familiar with the story of Outcast. Mm-hmm. And it was, you used your webcam. So you went to the site and you started watching this movie, and, or it was this weird kind of visual images. When you close your eyes, the visual images and the noise would stop, and you would hear in 3D audio the demon possessing you inside you, talking to you. And it was in 3D audio, so the demon was like swirling around your head. And when you open your eyes, the demon's voice would disappear, and you would see these weird messed up images on screen. So it was kind of like, you know, it was like basically you were bouncing. When you close, you hear the demon. When you open it, you see these kind of horrific images. So things like that were like really cool. They're not traditional. They're not like traditional, let's cut a trailer or let's make banner ads. It's not like that. You know, we did an epic campaign for Game of Thrones, but we also do things like strategy and positioning and helping these companies find the right audiences for the shows. So, you know, like Campfire NYC, there's a lot of the work you see, and you see like a huge campfirenyc.com. You see a huge breadth of work, anything from like physical immersive experiences, like a Westworld experience where you go and interact with people from Delos and hosts. Mm-hmm. and are immersed in the world. That's more like a theatrical experience, to, you know, like I described Outcast as a digital kind of experience, but all designed to really kind of create a sense of immersion and to take the story that's being told and tell different aspects of it in different ways.
Yeah, I actually saw, I just kind of skimmed through some of it earlier. I actually saw that you guys also worked with Ubisoft.
Yes.
On Assassin's Creed, right? Yeah.
Yeah, we did a little bit of work on Assassin's Creed. Yeah, that was an interesting franchise. I don't think we got to do as much immersive work as we would have liked to. But that's a fun franchise. That's probably towards the tail end of my gaming.
what's your favorite thing that you've worked on with Campfire personally?
Oh man. That's a hard one. That's a hard one because oftentimes it's like, my favorite thing is the next thing we're working on.
Okay. You
know, like I have this thing where I love them all when we get started. And then, you know, when they're over, they're kind of over, and my excitement goes to the next thing.
Sure.
So it's hard to call out a favorite, but there are some definite highlights, I think, from Campfire's history. And I think Outcast is one of them. The thing that I described you for Outcast is a highlight. Mm-hmm. I think the Westworld experience that we did at San Diego Comic-Con and New York Comic-Con is definitely a highlight. I think we did a project with Amazon for Man in the High Castle.
Oh, fun.
Oh, excellent.
Called Resistance Radio. And that one is one where I think the idea of Campfire and the idea of the kind of storytelling that Blair Witch started, the idea that pieces of the story can be told in different media and can all kind of build on each other. I think there's a case study film on the site for this, but Resistance Radio kind of comes closest to achieving that. And one of the things that I absolutely love is that, you know, the idea was to basically create a radio station from this alternate world with music from a world where rock and roll didn't happen, you know, youth revolution didn't happen from this alternate history. Mm-hmm. And the caliber of artists that we were able to get to record the songs, you know, like Beck and Nora Jones, Granddaddy, and all these incredible artists. And then, and to have a Danger Mouse and Sam Cohen produce the whole album and then for come out actually as an album that you can buy or that you can stream, like, you know, to be working on that from the marketing side and have it become integrated into the show, like mm-hmm. have that idea come integrated into the show and to create things that wouldn't exist from the show alone, that exist outside the show, but kind of further the story and the world building, to me is kind of like Resistance Radio, I think, comes closest to achieving that.
So kind of speaking of, you mentioned that the next thing is kind of what excites you. What is there anything like on the horizon that you're able to talk about, obviously?
There are many exciting things on the horizon, none of which I can talk about. Unfortunately, yeah. I'm generally not allowed to talk about the projects until after they've come out. Like, once they come out, then I can talk about them. It's one of the reasons that why, like, if you follow Campfire's social pages, you often don't see anything until all of a sudden it's like, hey, look what's here. And it's like,
I did notice that. I was doing the research. I was trying to find stuff. And I did actually notice that trend. Are you able to say, like, is it film? Is it more film? Is it more TV? Is it more like video games or other media? Can you say that at least?
We have multiple things going on.
Okay.
And so there's boy.
I think that's the cue to stop prodding.
I'm sorry. Yeah, you can tell me to stop.
There's something that involves gaming elements.
Okay.
Sorry to be a mystery. There's definitely something that involves franchises that I'm sure everyone listening to this podcast knows. Okay. And then there's some other things that are for some brands. And then there's like even further out on the horizon, there's some like new things that are coming out that haven't been seen, like brand new shows that are going to come out, you know, probably early next year or whatever that we're starting to work on now. So those things are all kind of in play. It's hard to talk about because sometimes, you know, you do this work in phases, like you do a little bit of work for them and then you kind of stop because it's so far out and then you hope that it gets picked up. But a lot of it depends on things like, you know, when a pilot goes, you start with some strategy. But then if the pilot isn't successful, the show could go away and then we could never see the light of day. So I don't like to jinx anything until it's solid. But there's a lot of exciting stuff on the horizon.
Okay, we'll move on. I won't keep poking then. So the last thing before we let you go, and this is something that I'm very excited about. And again, Justin, talk about me prodding. You might have to tell me to stop here too eventually. But Video Palace, you're the co-creator, right?
Yes.
Where did that idea come from?
That idea actually was inspired by... So Nick Braccia, the other co-creator, and I, who Nick up until recently worked at Campfire, we were called in one day by the marketing folks at Shudder, and which to me was like, oh my, fantastic, you know, like a horror audience, so we know that audience well. And we were called in and they didn't have a lot of money, but they kind of asked us to help come up with some kind of out of the box ideas, what they say, you know, like give us some strange ideas. And we pitched a bunch of things, but in the process of kind of looking at how people talk about Shudder, what we noticed was that a lot of people, when they describe Shudder to their friends, they would say, oh my God, it's like the best video store horror section in the 80s that you can remember, because they're bringing back a lot of catalog titles that no one else has.
Yeah.
You know, and it's curated by human beings. You know, it's not curated by algorithms. So the choices are top notch, and the way they group films is like, it's thoughtfully done the way it was done back in the VHS days before that things got corporate, right? Like where, you know, employees would put up a shelf of like, if you like these, this film, you'll like these. And it's not algorithm. It's based on the feel or, you know, things that we relate to as humans.
Yes.
And so people would describe Shudder as a video store. And so we kind of thought, oh, that's a really interesting way to take things. So we pitched some ideas that were kind of keyed off of that, looking at how fans were describing the project. And we pitched a kind of experiential idea, and it was, they didn't have the money. And I think, you know, knock on wood, when Shudder gets bigger, but they kind of said, what would you do to kind of seed this? Would there be a story you would tell to maybe seed this idea? And we thought, oh, well, we all thought there would be an interesting podcast to make off of this idea, which was a kind of a stunt. And she goes, and oh, well, you know what? We've just been tasked with making podcasts. I should introduce you to the programming team. And so she just made a contact to the programming team. Turns out that the head programmer there is somebody I had met at there's a format of game called Alternate Reality Game, which Campfire had been a part of in the early days, and we had made some alternate reality games. And there were these things called ARG Fests, which were fans of the game neighbors would come together. So I had met this guy, Owen, at AMC Networks there. And so we got back in touch. He's like, hey, how have you been? And so we talked, and he's like, yeah, I'm totally interested in hearing a pitch for podcast. So Nick and I sat down, and we just started kind of talking about ideas. Oh, what can we do? But it was keyed off of this idea. We were like, well, we want it to kind of reference that 80s video era that so many subscribers to Shudder are cued into and love and has the feel of Shudder. And from there, we just kind of spun it off as a mythology. But the idea was we want to tell a specific story that's designed for podcasts, but we want it to have a larger mythology in the background so that it's something that could, it's a story that could spread into other forms of media as well.
So how did Ben and Bob get involved with? Obviously, you worked with Ben on Blair Witch. Is that kind of where his name came to mind? And
well, yeah. Well, Ben and I had been talking. See, I've been tracking podcasts. Ben and I both have been tracking podcasts for years. And we've been kind of going like, at some point, a narrative fiction podcast is going to be viable. And we should be ready to do it. Mm-hmm. And so we've been talking for a couple of years about, we should do it. Yeah, let's, you know, it's kind of like the way we do Blair Witch. Like, yeah, we should do it. Yeah, one day, you know, and we, you know, we talk, we throw around a few ideas, but the truth is that the day jobs and the you know, the challenges of just making a living get in the way, and yeah. Especially as you get older and have kids. So when this opportunity popped up, we pitched it verbally. He said, "I'm interested," and then we said to Owen, like, "What do you need? What do you need to say yes?" And he said, I need to know what happens in every episode. Let's say there's 10 episodes. I need to know what happens in every episode and how it ends. This is because we won't agree to anything unless we know that it ends credibly.
Yep.
And so Nick and I sat down and we wrote a 10-page document that had kind of like who our main characters were and then a breakdown of what happens in each episode. And we pitched that longer story. And Shudder went, this is awesome, let's do it. And at that point, you know, Nick and I have these jobs at Campfire, which are full-on day jobs. And
yeah.
The budget level was such that it wasn't something we could really effectively roll into Campfire's work. You know what I mean? Like, it was content, it wasn't marketing. Campfire set up to be a marketing firm. Nick and I realized that the task of writing and directing was going to be too big for us to do in the time frame that we wanted to get it out there. It was too mm-hmm. big for us to really manage. So at that point, we called in Ben, who brought in Liam, the producer, who's amazing, and Bob, who's amazing, and who I knew from the Orlando days as well. Okay. And we brought them in, introduced them to Shudder. Shudder was like, great, love these guys. And so we were a go with Ben and Bob taking that 10-page outline and then fully scripting the story and Ben directing. And, you know, Ben directing Ben is the only person who could have directed Video Palace. And it's because of the work from Curse of the Blair Witch and then the other two specials that Ben directed himself.
Yeah.
You know, the way that he thinks about doing interviews and the way that he thinks about making sure that the things that are supposed to sound real actually sound authentic is essential, you know, and the way that he directed this piece absolutely has to do with the amazing performance, not just the casting, although the talent was fantastic as well.
Yes, it was.
But the way that Ben directed this was very different from the way most narrative podcasts are done, which is to say the actors didn't sit around a table talking into mics, you know what
I mean?
We
had Devin on she played Tamara, obviously, and she was talking to us about Ben's process and how he kind of set the scene and got them into character. And honestly, like, I would have never thought about that, but thank God Ben did, because that just, there's a realism to the Video Palace that really helps someone buy in. Like, even if you aren't big on podcasts, like that audio drama, like there is actual suspense and terror listening to it, because I was listening to it at work and I do lab work, and I was sitting in a tissue culture hood and I was sitting there like almost like nervous, like I'm broad daylight, like in a brightly lit room. And it's just crazy that you guys were able to produce something like that.
Yeah, it was, you know, there were some things that we really wanted to do, right? Like there was some initial, like, it shouldn't be a podcast, like in a podcast format. And I was like, no, we want it to be in a podcast format. Like that, that was one where I was absolutely insistent. And partially it's because, you know, there's a media theorist named Douglas Rushkoff who wrote a great book way back when called Media Virus. And there's a quote of his that I absolutely love. And he says, tell old stories in new mediums and new stories in old mediums, right? Which is to say that, you know, when you're in a new medium or a medium that's new for most people, think about genre, think about adaptations, think about telling stories that people are familiar with, because when you're experiencing a story in a new format, you need kind of guardrails to grab onto. Whereas if you're making a feature film, you can go all David Lynch nonlinear because people are familiar with a feature film. So you can go nonlinear and experiment because the concept of what a feature film is already a known or a novel, right?
Yeah.
And while podcasting's been around for over 10 years, the reality is it didn't really break out into the mainstream until Serial. And even then, the mainstream is still a very small percentage of the overall population.
Yeah.
And I was very insistent on the idea of, like, I know it's already considered a trope by people who have listened to a megaton of podcasts, but for most people, we need to create that bridge for them to get into the idea of listening to a fiction podcast. And podcast is intimate. It's in your ears through headphones. And it's not the same. It's not the same as radio drama. It's not the same. And I believe that you can make something in a radio drama style, but it has to be more intimate. The performances have to be more intimate. And so, I was very insistent on, like, you take a horror story, but you tell it in a format that people are comfortable with, and they'll roll with the horror. Like, they'll allow themselves to get immersed in it. You know, I think we have to take people on the journey as they discover podcasts. And I always wanted Video Pals to be very, very approachable, even to people who never listened to podcasts before.
And I can tell you succeeded because I recommended it to a couple of the grad students who I was working with, and they weren't even like into podcasts at all. But I told them, like, this is only 5 hours of your time. You won't regret it. And they felt the same way. Like, they felt like it was something so different and so unique, but yet so compelling that they bought in, and now they're podcast listeners. And it was because of the immersive fiction storytelling that you guys brought to the table. So
that's amazing.
Yeah.
I wish I promoted it.
Yeah. It's funny. Like, they kind of listened to mine, but they definitely listened to all of Video Palace. they checked out a few episodes of what we've done, but they bought into Video Palace. So with that, how was, it's all done. Obviously there's a lot of people on social media who are trying to figure out what happened to Mark Cambria, what comes next. How was Shudder's reception to the finished product and kind of what, almost a year now since it's come out?
Yep. So Shudder loved it. It's performed very, very well for Shudder.
Perfect.
We are talking about things. That's about as good as I can say.
You know, I'll take it.
Because that was the next question, right? Is, I mean, you develop these characters, and we talked to Devin about this when we had her on too, and like you left this huge like cliffhanger, and I want to know what comes next, and I won't go into it.
Do you think it's a cliffhanger? Do you think it's a cliffhanger?
Yeah, I mean, what happened to Mark? I mean, I sat here and pressed Bob like for 20 minutes trying to figure out like if it was aliens or Cthulhu or ghosts, what the hell was happening in that damn basement amongst the stacks. And I want to know. And I guess it's not like a true cliffhanger, like dun dun dun. Like, it's more like I need to know what happens next. I want more information. And I would be very sad if it isn't happening. But you're saying there's a chance we're getting more.
All right, let's see. What I would say is, let me frame this right. I love the people who say that Video Pals ends on a cliffhanger, because what it tells me is that you're deeply invested in the mythology as much as you're invested in the characters.
Yes.
Right? The fact that you want to know what happened to him and why. Like, because I think the story of Mark's arc kind of fit. If you look at it from the position of like, this is actually the theme of Video Pals, is that kind of collector mentality.
Yeah.
Right. What happens when you become an obsessive collector? Mm-hmm. And it's like taken almost to like an EC Comics level extreme in that sense, right? Yes. And so, if you look at it from that perspective, Mark's arc is done because he was an obsessive collector who got involved in something as a result of his obsession, and couldn't stop himself and took it all the way to an end that, spoiler alert, maybe wasn't quite the ending that he or Tamara would have liked, right? Which is what makes it horror, right? When to me, so I think
so. Mark is done, but Tamara, we're just diving into that one. That's what I need to see more of.
I think there's definitely more stories to tell with Tamara, and possibly with Mark too. I also think there's other stories to tell in the mythology. And I think, sure. You know, what I talked about earlier with, in terms of Blair Witch, right? Like when we talked about other stories starting to fill out that world, you know, the next film wasn't going to be hunting for Heather, Mike, and Josh.
Yeah.
And I think in that sense, the next thing you see from Video Palace may or may not be, it might be taking a completely different angle on the story, and you might get a sense of what happened. You might get a better sense of what happened to Mark, but it might not be a direct sequel, if that makes any sense.
So that's fine. I just want more.
So are you saying that whatever does come next at a Video Palace might not even be a podcast?
You know what? It was designed. What I'll say is I would not rule out a podcast. I would not rule out things that are not podcasts. It was designed. The mythology was designed to be something that stories could exist in lots of different forms of media.
Okay.
Right.
And if we were to hear more about the future of Video Palace, if there was some kind of hypothetical time frame, when should we be checking on Twitter for future information?
You know, all I can say is that you definitely want to follow Shudder on their social feeds, because anything that happens with Video Palace, you'll hear about it from Shudder first, most likely. So I would follow Shudder, and I can't really give a time frame now, but I can say that things always take longer than you'd like. They always move slower than you'd like, but there are talks and movement afoot.
Perfect. And will the crew be getting back together? Will you and Ben and Bob and Devin and everybody else be coming back if that's the story that's told next, do you think? Like, do you think they'd want Ben and Bob and you back? If something hypothetically were happening behind the scenes.
I think I've been pushed in terms of what I can talk about.
Fair. Look, okay, that's fair. we can end it there. So
I'll tell you this.
Okay.
You know, if something's going to happen with Video Palace, you know, Ben and Bob and the gang are the first people I would call. You know, you got to remember that we all have other projects going on, and so scheduling and things like that can come apart. But Video Palace is probably the other great, satisfying creative experience that I've had in a long time. And so I definitely have a vested interest in continuing to work with all those guys as much as possible, whether it's on Video Palace or other things.
That is one hell of a way to end the interview. Mike, thank you so much. Where can our listeners find you on social media and find more out about the projects you're a part of?
You can find me on Twitter at Mike Minnello. And I'm on LinkedIn and of course, campfirenyc.com find out about new campfire projects.
Do you ever watch a horror movie and think, oh, wow, that headshot didn't have nearly enough blood? Don't the writers know that 20% of your blood is in your head?
Are you the type of person that tells your friends, well, why yes, in space no one can hear you scream because the molecules are too far apart to transmit sound waves?
Does it seriously annoy you when a horror movie doesn't explain its rules to you or claims to have horror rules and then just ignores them?
Do you ever express these concerns to your friends who tell you that you should stop worrying so much because it's just a horror movie, Sam?
Then stop lecturing your friends about physics and come listen to our podcast, That's Not How Science Works, which I co-host with my awesome friend, Nicole.
In our podcast, Caitlin and I discuss science and different pieces of media, such as movies or TV shows, in various genres, and dissect whether that science is good, bad, or just plain ridiculous. Often, we also have special guests who help us rant about bad science in their areas of expertise.
We release new episodes every other Monday, and you can find us wherever you usually download your podcasts. We like to think of this as a podcast for the science curious. Whether you're Sam with a dedicated YouTube channel complaining about bad science and horror movies, or just like to learn things while listening to friends banter about what they watched that week, we'd love for you to listen in.
You can find out more by going to our website, thatsnotscience.com, or by looking us up on Twitter at TNHSWpod. We hope you give us a listen. Now back to your regularly scheduled horror enthusiasts, Larry and Justin, and that's definitely a word that's a real word and not a word that I just made up, and whatever terrifying thing they're discussing that would probably give me daymares for a week.
So if you sat through all of that, you know, if there is a future Video Palace, it may not be a podcast.
Oh, damn. You know what? I feel bad for pushing him. But
we let him listen to it. He didn't seem too bothered by it.
No, he was actually a really good sport about everything, and he was more than willing to answer what he could, and it was a lot of fun.
I will say, though, on the Blair Witch subject, it's not that I'm sad. It's more like knowing what the future of the franchise could have been, and then knowing that they've kind of cut out all these guys who really created the mythos and mythology for everything that's come since. It kind of bums me out. It doesn't detract from the original movie, but like, it's like, man, what if they had just given these guys like the creative freedom to do what they wanted?
Yeah, because like some of the stuff he was talking about would have been really interesting. Like,
could you imagine getting The Witch
years earlier?
15 years early?
Yeah, that's insane. I mean, not only that, like it's hearing him talk about that kind of stuff makes me interested to see where Lionsgate is. Because apparently this game that's coming out is canon.
That's what you said, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm really interested to see where Lionsgate is taking the
and
franchise.
And we will be playing it later on this season. So, yeah. Guys, thank you for listening. Thanks for hanging out. Next week, we are taking a quick break from Blair to review Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
Yep. Yeah,
I will say that Justin did not enjoy it as much as I did.
For reasons, but I can, yeah, you know, well, I'm going to save it, but yeah, we'll get into
and
it.
I think we can just quickly, before we get any further, this is a movie meant for young adults, kids.
Yep.
With that in mind, would you take your kids to this movie to get them inducted into horror?
I mean,
I don't have kids, but I definitely would. But I would also have taken them to Chucky, so I can't really talk too much.
I mean, I have a 3-year-old, so no. But I mean, like, if he was like...
You are taking your 3-year-old to Three from Hell later this year, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course. I'll be right on that. No, I mean, honestly, though, if he was like a young adult, maybe even like 7, I would take him to this easily. All right,
well, perfect. Guys, thank you so much. Make sure you go follow Mike on social media. Help support his projects. He puts out great stuff. And till next week, stay scary. The Here's Johnny podcast is brought to you by Larry and Justin. You can find the show on Twitter at Here's Johnny Cast, and you can find Larry at Beaver LA.
You can find Justin at Pickle Thing, and you can email the show at heresjohnnypodcast@gmail.com. You can look us up on Facebook at Here's Johnny Podcast.
As always, in the show notes, you can find links to the Discord and to the website. We are also on Instagram at heresjohnny_podcast.
Also in the show notes, we'll have a link to the Twitch and YouTube channels. And if you would like to support the show, you can head on over to patreon.com/heresjohnnypodcast. Every cent goes into the show. And yeah, we just really use it to make the show better. Again, I just want to say thank you very much to our patrons. You guys help make this possible.
But yeah, Patreon is the way we support the show. We aren't looking to get rich. And like Justin said, every dollar, every cent, it all goes back in. There's some pretty cool tiers, so head on and look at that.
But until next week, see you guys later.